I will promise you this, that if we have not gotten our troops out by the time I am president, it is the first thing I will do. I will get our troops home. We will bring an end to this war. You can take that to the bank.
Garbage in, garbage out.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Well, we have an extremely interesting show today. Our guest is Susan Lindauer. Susan is an American journalist, author, and anti-war activist. She was accused of conspiring to act as an agent for the Iraqi Intelligence Service and engaging in prohibited financial transactions involving the government of Iraq under Saddam Hussein. All charges were dropped in 2009 prior to any trial. She is also the author of Extreme Prejudice, the terrifying story of the Patriot Act and the cover-up of 9/11 and Iraq. Susan Lindauer, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
I'm so glad to be on, Cindy. This is terrific.
Well, thank you for being on. The first time that you really came to the forefront of my attention, of course, I've been peripherally aware of your other issues and things that you've been going through for a long time now, but was an essay that you did about Libya. And from what I understand, you used to work at the U.S. Embassy in Libya, and you have a perspective about the U.S.'s so-called humanitarian intervention there. Can you briefly tell my listeners about what you think is or what you know is really going on in Libya?
Well, actually, it's very significant. I was actually a U.S. asset covering the Libyan and Iraqi embassies in New York at the United Nations.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, that's okay. I was a back channel during the Lockerbie negotiations, and I know that Libya had nothing to do with Lockerbie. Last summer, we began to hear that Libya was pressuring the United States to provide U.S. oil companies to provide kickbacks and reimbursements for the costs that Libya had borne from the sanctions from the Lockerbie case.
Right.
And it's just to keep this very short, it had been discovered that the United States bribed witnesses, paid $4 million per witness to testify against Libya at the Lockerbie case. And it was a sham trial. It was a fraud.
So then
Libya began to try to get damages from the United States, and now they've launched this war, and it's the humanitarian effort is a fraud. It is a front for the oil companies.
Well, what is the connection between the person that they just recently released to Libyan custody that was supposedly the mastermind of the Lockerbie bombing?
His name is Abdelbaset Megrahi, and he received a compassionate release because he had stage 4 prostate cancer, and he was expected to die. Of course, how often do you really care that an inmate's going to die in prison? It is very rare that anybody would get such a release. And
right.
The reason for the release was it was discovered the United States had bribed witnesses in the case against him, and they have recanted their testimony. They said that they shaped their testimony because they received $4 million apiece to testify. And so this is a big disgrace for the United States. Libya was justifiably furious because, in fact, Libya had nothing to do with Lockerbie. It was to cover up CIA heroin trafficking out of the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon during the 1980s. And the CIA had, Islamic Jihad had bombed an airplane a CIA team, FBI team, that was heading back to Washington to report on the heroin trafficking out of Lebanon.
And who were these witnesses? I mean, what supposed connection did they have to it?
Well, their testimony was that they had identified Abdelbaset Megrahi as having purchased clothes at a store in Malta. And this was a very shaky connection to the Lockerbie case to begin with. And Tony Gucci had said that first the witness identified Abu Taub, who is a very famous terrorist who, in fact, had bombed Northwest Airlines and El Al Airlines, Israeli Airlines, and who is in prison for life for the assassination of some major people, a newspaper publisher, I believe the Prime Minister of Sweden. And so he was an assassin. He bombed the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires. He's a big terrorist. And first he was identified, and then the United States came back and said, are you sure, what about this guy over here, and they kept pressuring the guy, and he backed down, and he said, okay, he did it instead, and it turns out that he was paid to say that.
Wow. You wrote a good piece about this that people can reference if they want to go, and we will, of course, link it on the website. But what is the name of the piece you wrote about this Libyan? And I think you wrote it back in April before.
Libya's Blood for Oil, The Vampire Wars, and Putting Out Fire with Gasoline.
Do you have
a blog or something?
So there are two
articles.
Do you have a blog or something?
Yes, my blog is extremeprejudiceusa.wordpress.com, and of course, Extreme Prejudice is the title of my new book, which goes into the real story of the 9/11 warnings, the 9/11 investigation, a comprehensive peace framework that was on the table that no one even knows existed but had been developed over a two-year period before the invasion. And it shows you a totally different perspective on Iraqi pre-war intelligence, and it proves the war in Iraq could have been easily avoided. All of the things the United States was trying to achieve were already on the table, and the Iraqis were willing to give us everything, including democratic reforms, contracts for American corporations, telecommunications, healthcare, pharmaceuticals, transportation. Iraq offered to buy 1 million American-made automobiles every year for 10 years, and I laughed when I heard this, and the diplomat in question said, "What? That's not good enough. Do you want 20 years?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "I'm sure that'll be fine."
Well, let's definitely. I do want to get into more about that. Of course, you know, I believe that on September 11th of 2001, that's really when my son Casey's death warrant was signed. And of course, Casey's just one of over a million people that have been killed and millions of people that have been harmed by the illegal and immoral war in Iraq. But let's go to, first before we get into that, let's go to Afghanistan and Pakistan and the so-called connection of bin Laden with 9/11, Osama bin Laden, and his recent quote-unquote execution by Barack Obama's team of Navy SEALs. And I don't believe anything about the official story about that. But what is your take on all of this? And, you know, I know your book is mostly about Iraq because that was your expertise, but I also feel that the invasion of Afghanistan was unwarranted and based on lies also. So what is your take on that whole situation?
Well, first of all, this is a very important question, and it's a bigger question than you realize, because my book actually shows how 9/11 and Iraq intersected. First of all, hold your breath, sit down, take a drink of water. A lot of people have trouble with this. We knew about 9/11 before it happened. I was ordered in April and May of 2001 to begin issuing threats to my contacts at the Iraqi embassy in New York, telling them that when 9/11 occurred, the United States would declare war on Iraq.
Wow.
And I swear I will testify to this on Capitol Hill. You can you know, I would be willing to, I live in the Washington suburbs, I'd be willing to go down to Capitol Hill anytime, and you can look me in the eye, you can pound me with any kind of question you want. I will answer everything under oath. I have witnesses who have verified that the 9/11 warnings are true. And but the hardest part is for Americans to understand. We knew 9/11 was going to happen. Now,
right.
I think with regards to the Osama bin Laden assassination, whether it happened now or whether it happened 10 years ago, the reason I think that they're bringing it out right now is because they want to kill off the 9/11 story. They believe that if enough Americans are going to say, hey, as long as we've got Osama bin Laden, we don't need to look any closer. We don't need to dig any deeper. We don't need to know the truth anymore, because as long as we've got the guy who allegedly did it, what does it matter? Mm-hmm. Well, it's a lot more complicated than that, as Cindy, as you just pointed out. We did know about the attack. I am one of the people who does believe there were airplane hijackings in coordination with a demolition of the building.
Mm-hmm.
We knew in advance that there was going to be the attack involving, it was very precise. We were told over and over again it would involve airplane hijackings and a strike on the World Trade Center. By June, my CIA handler, Dr. Richard Fuse, and I were talking about this attack about every week. In August of 2001, I was told not to go back to New York City because the attack was imminent. We expected mass casualties and a possible thermonuclear device.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that stopped the CIA was they didn't know that I went to my friends who lived, I have friends in New York, and I told them to stay out of the city. My brother was living in Hoboken, New Jersey, which is, of course, right across the water from New York. I told him not to go into the city, and I had civilian witnesses who then became aware of the attack. That is the only thing that saved me, because I was then, as my book Extreme Prejudice discusses, I got arrested on the Patriot Act. I was held under indictment for 5 years from March of 2004, 6 months before the election of George Bush versus John Kerry,
mm-hmm.
all the way through to January of 2009, my indictment ended 5 days before Barack Obama's inauguration.
Well, first of all, we know through other sources besides yourself that at George Bush's very first staff meeting as president, his first question was, how do we get Saddam Hussein? And then on August 6th, of 2001, I remember that day precisely because that's in 2005. That's the exact date that I went to Crawford, and Bush was in Crawford on August 6, 2005, and he was handed a presidential daily briefing that said Osama bin Laden determined to strike in the U.S. And so we know that there were definitely these indicators that the Bush administration wanted to go into Iraq, but you're saying that you had actual orders to
Yes. We need to be clear about something. You mentioned the early meetings in January and February 2001, right when Bush comes into power. We did not know about those directives for another couple of years.
Right.
So at the time, those were classified directives. They were only within a tight, narrow circle. It's very difficult. It's understandably difficult for some people to understand this, but the facts are that the top people knew what they were going to do, but they kept the assets, like me, in the dark. The whole time I was working with Iraq, we were working on a comprehensive peace framework to get the weapons inspectors back into Baghdad, to get cooperation with anti-terrorism. We had an invitation in February of 2001 to get the 6 months before 9/11 to get the FBI into Baghdad with authorization to conduct terrorist investigations and even make arrests. And we had, by the summer, we had contracts for American oil, contracts for telecommunications, and all these other sectors. And this was a comprehensive peace framework a year before the invasion in March of 2002. We had Iraq's agreement for major democratic reforms where Saddam would probably not even be participating. And I even went back and reported that perhaps Saddam was dying because it was such an incredible thing for someone from the Revolutionary Council to tell me in Baghdad that Saddam was possibly not even going to be around. I thought, my God, the man must be dying. So you didn't have to go to war. There was no reason to go to war. Everything you wanted, you could have had. And the whole point was that in 9/11 was a Pearl Harbor day. They needed the international community in the summer of 2001. Americans don't usually think what the international community is doing because we think we're the only ones that count. But in the international community in 2001, there was a deep antipathy and loathing of the United Nations sanctions on Iraq. The world community was sick of it. 2 million Iraqis had died of sanctions, including 1 million children under the age of five. Education was wiped out. Literacy was wiped out. It was a disaster. And so they had to have something that would force the world community to, you know, that would turn the whole thing around, and it would upsize the whole opposition to war, because otherwise it would be impossible for the United States to do anything at all. And so they quote unquote needed 9/11.
And so what's the connection between this the ignoring of the peace options and the fast roll to invading Iraq? And what's the connection between that and the connection between the Bush administration's deep ties to oil and other companies like Halliburton?
Yeah, it's a tragedy. It's like it is a horrible tragedy. This was an oil war, obviously, and it was a war for Israel. And, you know, I have Jewish friends and people, you know, every time you say Israel, people say, oh, you must hate Jewish people. I don't.
Exactly.
That is absolutely not true. But we are fighting this war for Israel. And we have launched a lot of attacks that are not necessarily in our best interest because we have these two misguided markers, misguided, you know, objectives, which is to help Israel and to get oil. And actually, the irony is that by destroying Iraq's economy, the sanctions and the war have degraded the oil equipment and industry so badly inside Iraq. The oil pipelines, the oil infrastructure that's needed for the pumping stations are no longer functional. And so now they're looking for, they can't get to the oil. It's cost prohibitive to go after their oil. So now you see them going after Libya. And I just think that that's just an extraordinary thing, that the United States oil industry is essentially, the sanctions and the war in Iraq defeated our own objectives. It defeated Halliburton's, not our objectives. It's not your and my objectives,
right,
Cindy. It's Halliburton's objectives. We defeated Halliburton's objectives, and now they're turning their sights on somebody else. And Libya had threatened them by trying to get compensation for the damage from the sanctions that their country suffered because of the phony Lockerbie case.
Right.
And that is how you have this whole thing come into play. And unfortunately, people think that it's a humanitarian war, and therefore it's okay to do this. But in fact, there's nothing humanitarian about it. We're training a new Taliban in Libya. I am convinced of that. I know the Libyan people, and I categorically deny that there's anything racist about this statement, but the Libyan people are very tribal. They are conservative Islamic people. They are deeply Islamic, and they have a deep resentment of outsiders, and I don't know what kind of game the United States thinks it's playing, but these people are not going to be our friends when this is over. They're probably telling us whatever they think we want to hear. And I even heard from somebody that Israel is talking about setting up a military base inside Libya. And this was someone from the Lockerbie case who's very reputable, who had told me this. And I am wondering, you know, it's a very credible source. But if the Libyan rebels are making promises like to Israel that Israel is going to provide financing for the war and against Gaddafi, and then they're going to have a military base as payment, then I just know that these people are just playing games, and they're anything that they want, they think we want to hear, they're going to tell us. But they have their own agenda, and it's not our agenda, and we need to remember that.
Well, it's history repeating itself. I mean, that's exactly what happened when we supported the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. You know, it's almost like a twin event of history repeating itself. But I want to get back to something that you said, because I believe that many people understand war profiteering and the oil companies and how, you know, for the existence of big oil, it has been had an inordinate and a very unhealthy and destructive, influence on U.S. foreign policy. But explain, you know, I know how this is, but explain how these wars could be a benefit for Israel, and explain why the United States would even care about Israel's interest over our own interests.
Well, you know, I have to say that sometimes I wonder why they do care so much, mm-hmm. because we are exciting hatred all over the Middle East by these wars. We are depleting our treasury. We're bankrupting ourselves. The military-industrial complex is not good for soldiers. You know, all this big defense spending is not helping American soldiers. They were sent over to Iraq without proper body armor, for example, but we had the fanciest weapons on earth. And they, you know, I have a next-door neighbor who works at Walter Reed, and she was telling me that they were coming home with triple amputees. People who used mm-hmm. to die are now surviving, or you know, at the height of the war, were surviving, but they were coming home just badly, badly maimed. And these are young men. I mean, I hate to say, Cindy, please don't take this the wrong way, but sometimes it's better to have a death than to have what happens if you don't, please, I don't want to upset you. But, you know, it's just a question as to whether we have, I don't want to upset you, so.
No, you know, I totally get it. Not only is the military spending bad for our soldiers, but it's bad for our students. It's bad for our old people. It's bad for the environment. It's bad for our economy in general. And
yes.
So, but
I agree with everything you just said. Yes.
How does it benefit Israel? Israel gets a lot of our money anyway. Israel gets at least $3 billion a year.
Israel gets $5 billion a year because they get they get money off the black budgets as
right,
well.
Right.
And so they get some officially recognized dollars, and then they get some black budget money, which is concealed. And it could even be up to $7 billion. I've heard the figure raised. But these are enemy. You know, they're targeting governments. The United States has been targeting governments that are perceived as deep enemies of Israel. They're not enemies of the United States. Iraq, before the invasion, kept saying, Susie, you know, we want to be friends with you guys. We oppose those terrorists just like you do. Saddam Hussein was tough on terrorism. And the irony is that their government had been one of our best supporters of anti-terrorism intelligence throughout the 1990s, because Saddam was so paranoid of these Islamic fundamentalists, he was afraid that the sanctions and the breakdown of civil authority would be a magnet of attracting
right.
them to his country, and he
right.
wanted to get that. He wanted to see them behind bars. So he was on the same page as Dick Cheney. I mean, you don't like Dick Cheney, you don't like Saddam Hussein, you don't like Dick Cheney. They're the same. They're identical to one another.
And Iraq was not as the right wing wants to portray. It wasn't a backwards Islamic country. It was very westernized and, you know, educated. There were, you know, university degrees, and women were in all of these high-level jobs and in the government, and it was not like Afghanistan under the Taliban.
That is absolutely correct. Iraq performed the second heart transplant in the world because before sanctions, it had one of the best hospital systems in the world. It had the most advanced, most progressive rights for women as far as education rights, job rights. A lot of Islamic countries don't let women hold jobs at all. And these women have jobs. They have the rights of inheritance, the rights of divorce. They have things that we would have. And so Saddam, before the war, the Iraqi diplomats kept saying, look, you know, we're westernized. We appreciate you. We want to resume our alliance with the United States like we had before the first Gulf War. And they saw themselves as a counterpoint to Iran. And they really tried to sell us on this, that they were the best thing to protect the United States against Iran. They would be a buffer for us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and Saddam, in many regards, was right. The only beneficiary of the Iraqi war was Israel, because Saddam hated Israel. And I will tell you, so do the other Arab people and the other Arab governments.
I've been to those countries, and they recognize the existential threat to them. Well, Susan Landauer, we're almost out of time. Before I want my listeners to know that you are planning a tour for your book, Extreme Prejudice, and I want you to give them your website again or contact information. And I know you do want people to help organize your West Coast stops, which I think would be very valuable for you to get out and talk about these things. But name somebody in the Bush administration that you know for sure had advanced knowledge of the 9/11 attacks.
President George Bush.
All right.
Vice President Dick Cheney.
Okay,
Condoleezza
so from
Rice.
George Bush on down to George
Tenet, the director of the CIA. I was told by my CIA handler in May of 2001, and I would go on to Capitol Hill and swear this under oath and get pounded with questions on this. I was told in May of 2001 to threaten Iraq with war, and that it came, if the conspiracy involving airplane hijackings and a strike on the World Trade Center was carried to fruition. And they said to me that, and I said, you know, oh, Richard, I don't want to issue a threat like that. That's a really, you know, I want to do it a different way. I'll ask for the intelligence. He said, no, we want to make sure they understand this threat comes from the highest level of government above the CIA director, which is George Tenet, and above the Secretary of State. And he said, you make sure that the Iraqis understand this comes from way above the cabinet level. Those were his exact words, above the cabinet level.
Let me ask you one other question that seems like an obvious question to me. If the United States was, you know, doing this to frame Iraq into a war, and if it was like a coordinated attack, why were all of the most of the people on the airplanes from Saudi Arabia then?
Well, I mean, that was who they, you know, these were CIA, I mean, a lot of these guys, the Saudis, were actually CIA assets.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a very interesting thing, that they weren't just arbitrary Arabian Saudi men. They were U.S. assets who'd been in Afghanistan, who the United mm-hmm. States and the CIA had developed relationships with,
mm-hmm.
and would have been monitoring extremely closely. It would have been an extraordinary thing if a U.S. asset was not heavily supervised and controlled. So, which tells you that we absolutely knew about 9/11. I have another article coming out this coming week, which is going to show how the airplane hijackings correspond to the demolition, the explosives that are planted in the World Trade Center building. These are not contrary to what everybody believes, this is not mutually contradictory. These things actually fit together very well. And I'm going to explain that in the next article and also talk about Israel's advanced knowledge of 9/11, because we know that they knew too. And,
well, let me ask you one other question. I was on your blog earlier, and I noticed that you answered a concern from Valerie Plame, the CIA operative who was outed reportedly by the Bush administration for her husband Joseph Wilson, Ambassador Joseph Wilson's kind of questioning of the official story of the yellow cake uranium. But she makes a valid point, and you had a valid answer to her, is how do these things keep secret if everybody knows about it? How is it still mostly, there's many people who are, seeking the truth and have a handle on the fact that it probably is not the official story of the 9/11 Commission report, but how is this kept secret, as much as they have kept it secret without somebody spilling the beans?
In my case, I can tell you that my CIA handler got $13 million tax-free as a payoff right after 9/11. It came off the 9/11 emergency appropriations in the black budgets. And I was in his office when he got it, and he was ecstatically elated. And I said, hey, wow, we've got money to do this work. And he said, oh, no, forget that. I'm building a house.
Wow.
And he built himself a mansion. And then in my case, as my book Extreme Prejudice reveals, I was held under indictment for 5 years with no trial. I was locked in prison on a Texas military base for a year. My reputation was destroyed. They attacked me as viciously as you could ever imagine. And of those who knew that my 9/11 warnings were true, we know that the FBI had verified my 9/11 warnings. Let's just pretend that they didn't know about the 9/11 warnings before they arrested me. Let's pretend.
Right.
Okay, they learned about it by April of 2004, which is 6 months before the 9/11 Commission report is issued. The FBI knew it. The U.S. Attorney's Office in New York knew it. The Attorney General's Office in Washington knew it. The Office of Counterterrorism knew it. The CIA and Defense Intelligence Agencies knew it. And then when I get to, and that's 6 months before 9/11, before the 9/11 Commission report even comes out, I offered to testify and to waive my Fifth Amendment rights. I want you all to know that. Now, this is very interesting because I said, when you're under indictment, anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You better believe that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But what I told them was that I wanted to testify, and I called their bluff because I knew they didn't have any kind of case against me. And I said, I will testify before the 9/11 Commission right now. Now that the FBI has verified my 9/11 warnings, we know they've talked to my CIA handler, my defense intelligence handler. We know that they know this is true. I will waive my Fifth Amendment rights so that I can testify and tell what I know, and then you can continue your prosecution.
Well, Susan, tell my listeners the name of your book again and how they could get more information, your website, or how they can contact you about your book tour.
My book is Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 in Iraq. My website is www.extremeprejudiceusa.com. WordPress.com. It's available on Amazon, and we're working out a book tour that'll run from California up to Seattle in July and August. So I'd love to come speak to you. And again, I'm willing to answer. I'm willing to look you in the eye, and you can ask me every kind of question. I will talk as long as you let me talk,
well,
and I'll tell you everything you want to know.
When you're in California, I hope to come out to your talk if I'm available. So, Susan Lindauer, thank you for your work, and thank you for spending time here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Okay, talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, that was our guest, Susan Landauer. I hope you check out her book and her website. We will link that to our website, CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Thank you for listening to the show. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Petty, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey, you for listening, and I'd like to thank our guest, Susan Landauer. We're almost up to our 100th show, and we're going to have a surprise for our 100th show in two more shows. So stay tuned, and we'll talk to you next week. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
I must make my witness. Have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.